Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with keyboardist and composer, the delightfully exuberant Robbie Rose. Robbie Rose, who decided that music, all the music, every kind of music that he could hear from the time he could hear, was magic. And when you hear him talk and when you hear him play, you know that he is communicating with every word and every note his love of the magic in the music. Listen to Robbie talk about how he became the player that he is, and listen to the title cut from his CD called Hot Sauce, an original composition for Hammond organ. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources, oh,
is about being the person you really are, the entire person that you are. You may be thinking, well, how could I be anything other than what I am? But it's clear to me, as a psychotherapist, that most of us are not being all that we really are. Most of us are being some of who we really are and hiding or being in denial for, or out and out pretending to be something that we're not. People pretend by acting as though they got a joke they didn't get, right? That's pretending to be something that you're not. Or putting something on your resume that you didn't do. Or allowing people to believe something about you that isn't actually true. Or refusing to say whether you liked something or not until somebody else says they liked it. This kind of stuff is pretty common, but it isn't really what I'm talking about. I'm saying that too many of us were forced in our childhood to deny something essential about us, something about the way we talked or thought or an impulse that we had, something that we were drawn to. Unfortunately, childhood can be full of criticism, chastisement, embarrassment, teasing, and lots of people surrender parts of themselves rather than experience that. So the Lin Show is about saying, if this happened to you, it may not be too late to recover what you have lost, what you sacrificed, what you are currently denying. And if you want to have more information about that, you can go up on my website, which is thelinshow.com. thelinshow, thelinshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lin. Up there, you can email me, ask me any questions you like. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. You can get a copy of my book, which is When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can listen to every show I've done and every interview I have aired, including the one I'm about to do now with the delightful and remarkably talented Robbie Rose. As I said in the run-up, Robbie discovered the magic of music very, very young and has never let go of it. And also, as I said, at the end of the show, I'm going to play Hot Sauce, the title tune from his CD and also an original composition. But now, since this is a fairly long interview and I didn't want to cut any more than I had to, I'm going to turn the stage over to the delightful Robbie Rose. Okay, I'm here with Robbie Rose.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Robbie. And I'm explaining to Robbie that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I believe that the art to which you have been giving your life and making your living is the art of music, the art of piano playing. Is that accurate?
Guilty as charged.
Yes, okay, good. That's what I thought. I have seen you play many times, and I know that this is true. Okay, so I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment that music or playing or humming or singing drew you, captured you, called you?
Yeah, wow, good question. I grew up in the 60s in Detroit area, born in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And some of my earliest memories are around music. In those days, just about all the music that came out seemed to be magic. You know, the funk and soul and R&B music was so good. Detroit era was known for Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime we put on the radio or put on a record or got in the car and the radio came on, every song seemed like it was magic. And from about the age of like 3, I was pretty certain I would never do anything other than music. Why would anyone do anything else? It was so good. Everybody would pile in for it, and the radio would come out, CKLW, which is still there in Windsor, Ontario, Detroit, right across the street there. And every single song was magic. And plus, we knew that these men and women who sang and composed all these songs were our neighbors.
Oh, yes.
They were all in Detroit. So they were all lived within a 50-mile radius of my front door. And it was like, I just thought that's what everybody did. Why would you do anything else other than music? It was so good.
Okay, so now, when you say it was magic, I love that. Do you think that your family also felt that, or just you?
Yes, they certainly did. My mother and father, may they rest in peace, were avid jazz fans. They knew thousands of songs. The piano in our living room had several large volumes on the top, right? There was the complete works of George and Ira Gershwin. There was the Rodgers and Hart songbook.
Oh, my God.
Rodgers and Hammerstein. The complete works of Cole Porter. They knew thousands of tunes.
Did they play?
They both could play, and they both could sing a little bit. They were too smart to go into it as a profession. They both had great voices, which, of course, as a child, I hated. Like, my son hates my voice now. Daddy, stop singing. Oh,
really?
Now, what I wouldn't give to hear my father sing a Cole Porter song or a George Gershwin song. It wasn't just music that I personally liked. It seemed to be all music was magical. My parents' music was magical. The Motown music was magic. The gospel music that was on the end of the dial, some little Christian station, that stuff was amazing. Then as I started to grow up, I got into, you know, rock and roll and heavy metal, Beatles and Stones. That music was all magic. So yeah, I just felt like no matter which way you go in music, it's all good.
Oh, God, that's wonderful. Okay, so your parents played piano?
Piano, guitar, percussion, and they both had nice voices.
Wow.
In fact, my father had a beautiful voice from a very, very young age.
Yeah.
Could have been a cantor.
But he wasn't.
No, he was an epidemiologist.
Oh, I see.
Public health man.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, so when did you start to play?
I always noodled around on a piano, organ, guitar.
In by ear?
Yeah, totally by ear. And then one night after dinner, I sat down at the piano and I started playing as time goes by.
You're kidding.
I think that was about 5, maybe 6. Very, very young. And I started playing and I felt something and I looked up. Both my parents were standing there, jaws dropped.
Right.
Right?
Right.
My father started to correct me because I did this one little thing that I didn't get something right. And I remember my father saying, "You shut up, you don't correct him. That's beautiful. You just let him go."
Oh, your mother saying that.
My mother saying
right,
to
right,
my father.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And in retrospect, I often wondered, how did I know how to do that?
How did you?
I mean, I've been hearing great music since birth, probably since conception.
Yes.
Actually.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you watch them play?
Not really. I listened to them play. And after some time, I watched them play. But I don't think that early. I knew to just noodle a little bit. Get the right chords. Then I remember that song. And I played almost the whole song, almost all the way through, just like that. And so that's when they started to get me lessons. And
yeah.
I had some natural gifts. Of course, I had to do a lot of hard work.
Well, let's talk about that. So they said, oh, my God, we better give this kid lessons. So what happened?
Well, I started to get lessons with a few different teachers. And it took a while to find somebody that was really a good mentor for me. I had a number of teachers who were all good teachers. But it happened that I found this fellow that just was the perfect teacher for me. This guy... It was very, very dedicated. In fact, anything I wanted to learn, he actually would transcribe and write out by hand any piece of music I wanted to learn. Because at that time, progressive rock, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and yes, this was rock and roll that was almost like classical music.
Oh, absolutely.
It had many different sections. It was very complex, and there were no sheet music for this. Really, most people wouldn't have been able to play it. It's too complicated. Yeah. This guy would go home and write everything out, and he didn't get paid for all these hours. He just did it for me. And then, as I was coming into my high school years,
you're not even in high school yet when this is happening.
No, this is like elementary school, junior high. And then my teacher became the teacher at the local music and art school. There is a music and art school outside of Ann Arbor, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's called Community High, which is now a very, very well-known, highly acclaimed school. At that time, it was brand new. And there was a fear that, if you go to the school, you won't be able to get into college. It was the first school in Michigan that had its own nursery. Because there were a lot of pregnant, you know. It was the first school in Michigan that allowed smoking. I used to call it the granola school. It was full of fruits, nuts, and flakes.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I'm actually quite serious.
So your parents chose to send you to this school?
They allowed me to go. My teacher offered advanced music theory courses. I ended up studying music theory 6 days a week.
Wow.
I later went to New England Conservatory, which is a great place, but I'll tell you, this class in high school was better than anything I had in the conservatory.
Wow.
Started out with about 45 kids. Mm-hmm. By the end of the second year, there were 3 kids left.
Oh, my goodness.
There was me and my friend Davey Mann, who is now quite well known, a great jazz musician in New York. He's played at the White House and everything else. He's been on tons of records, toured all over. And one friend of ours, this lady, Tamar, she's written classical, and it was the 3 of us that were left. Nobody else survived. Basically, this was my music theory class that was so intense. Imagine a class of 40 or so kids,
right,
seated at tables, little wooden tables, old-fashioned, you know. This is back in the 70s. And the teacher's at the front with a piano. He says, "All right, class dictation." We get out our manuscript paper,
right,
pencils at the ready, pencil, not pen. You gotta make mistakes. And so he goes, "Key of C, dun-dun-dun," he plays a C chord. You can hear a C, so we zero in on the C. So we're writing on our staff's key of C, if there's, you know, whatever sharps and flats, we get it ready. And he would play. And we had to write down everything he played.
Oh, you're kidding.
On 2 staves. Right hand, left hand, same time.
Oh, my God.
And it started out very simple, you know. He would play just single notes. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, no problem. One note pickup, da, and then one, da, da, it's 5-1, so that's G, C, da, 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 da. And by the end, he's playing like miniature classical pieces, and we're writing everything down. And every week, there are fewer and fewer kids.
Yeah, right, right.
But in the second year, like I say, it was me and two others who survived.
Okay, so you fell in love with this with a deep passion. I mean, you were going to do whatever it required. That's what it sounds like. You're saying that as though, yeah, that's no big deal, but it is a big deal, as you can tell by the fact that 40 kids didn't make it. So this is high school, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You go through this incredibly intense learning, and then you graduate, and then what happens?
Well, so then after that, I ended up going to New England Conservatory in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you the story. It's a very simple one. I figured New York was the best place for me.
Yeah?
But I was this nice Jewish boy from Michigan, from a small town, and I didn't feel I was really ready for New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured I'd go to Boston first and then make my way down to New York
mm-hmm.
from Boston.
Right.
Which I think was pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
If I had gone straight to New York from a small town in Michigan and I was not streetwise,
yeah.
You know. Anyway, New England was a great place. I learned a lot. I made some connections. I ended up making some connections with these guys, and I built a recording studio with two other friends, which is still working today. It's called Soundscape Recorders in downtown Boston. It's in the Fort Point Channel District. And the studio I built is now Studio C. There's also Studio A and B that are newer. You know? So they
so
now have three studios.
So now you, when you say I built it, that means you also know stuff about recording, about audio, about machines, and all that stuff.
Yes. In fact, I know a great deal about it. Unfortunately, it's changed so much that about 80% of what I learned then and know so much about is almost completely useless. Well, I had this experience that really was one of the defining things that made me who I am today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know George Russell. He had some big-selling jazz albums. He was at New England Conservatory, and he hired me to do a big tour of Europe. And I was about 19 at the time, and I didn't have much experience. I was already a good player, but I didn't have much experience. So I went in to the first rehearsal, and I got a stack of music. It was like bigger than a Tokyo Yellow Pages, right? And I'm looking through it, and it was a lot of notes, not just chord symbols. It was really difficult reading. Okay. Now, I didn't know his music very much. I didn't do my homework like I should. But it came in. There was this one song. It's called All About Rosie. Apparently, Bill Evans had played the piano part on the record. So I'm filling big shoes.
Yeah, right.
By the way, did I mention it was a full big band, 26 guys. 26 of the finest musicians in Boston and New York. And I was by far the youngest kid there. You know, most were much older than me. So I'm in. We're doing this big band, great players, and I'm a little nervous. And we're playing through, I think I did okay. We come to the song All About Rosie. Well, I didn't know it. But there's a big section that's all solo piano where the whole orchestra drops out. I didn't know that. And it's not written anywhere on the chart. So we're playing along and I got kind of lost. And I noticed there's just millions of notes. It's like the page is almost black. There's so many notes. And it comes up to that part. Everybody dropped out and I felt a strange energy in the room. And I looked up. Those 26 great musicians were all staring at me.
Yeah, of course they were, right.
So my heart rate increased and I shrunk down in the piano bench. And George had this thick, like, old school black American accent, you know. Piano player! Where you at, man? Where you at? And he walks over to me and he's towering over me and I'm like kind of shaking my boots, you know. And he goes, that's you right there. And I said, me? What do you mean? And he said, that's our solo piano right there. And I said, oh, I didn't know. It's not marked on the chart. Is that letter C? He said, yeah, letter C. He'd take it again. So we took it again. And I don't want to say I played it well, but I played it a little bit better. And over to me and he stands next to me. He says, you going to cut this gig, man, or not? And I said, I'll try, George. And with all these musicians looking at me. And he said, and I quote, man, you do it or you don't do it. But I ain't gonna have no motherfuckers on my bandstand trying.
Ooh.
The end of the story, it might sound sad, I didn't make it. I actually bowed out. I went home and I did some work on the charts and I had a week and a half to prepare and I didn't think at that time I was good enough reader to prepare well enough. And I bowed out of the gig and I said, I bowed out, but I learned a very valuable lesson. And to this day, no one will ever hear me trying on bandstand. You come to hear me, right? You hear me play?
That's right.
I play.
That's right.
I don't try none.
No.
I'm doing it, that's it. So it actually has a happy ending, although it was a terrifying experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I went home with my tail between my legs, and I practiced my butt off, you know? And I, furthermore, I learned this valuable, valuable lesson in art. Really, in any art, you don't want to see anybody trying something.
No.
Any art. I don't care if it's a painting. I don't want to say, hey, I like the way that guy tried to make the woman look. You know, right? This is a very valuable lesson in art. And, you know, if it had been softer the way it was presented to me, I wouldn't have learned it as well.
No.
I needed to get my ass kicked.
No. I think, now, well, maybe this isn't true, but because you started at the top, I mean, you sat down and played. From the beginning, you had the sense you could do whatever needed to be done. Sometimes that works against you when it comes as easy as it came to you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and yes, it works against some people because they don't try hard
enough. They don't try hard enough. So that moment in time corrected you. It was like a self-correction, right?
Yes, yes, and sometimes, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child.
Yeah,
we need the rod sometimes. And later, I played some very high-powered gigs with other people like Cab Calloway, Gil Evans, Jerry Bergonzi, Rick Margitza, and others. And I already knew not to try. Don't ever let them catch you trying.
No.
Even if you might try for a minute, make it look like you meant it. You know what I mean? Like, so I, from that day on, I never tried.
No.
I mean, yeah, I tried at home.
Yeah.
Practice, you learn. Right. But you get on that bandstand, and man, lights go down, one, two, one, and there's no trying anymore.
No.
You just do it.
No, and I've seen you play.
It's
not only that I've heard you play, I've seen you play. And I see the concentration and the focus that you bring to it. I know you're not trying.
It's funny you say that. A lot of people, non-musicians, say, why are jazz musicians so serious? And it's a funny question because actually I've always admired those jazz musicians who could sit there with a huge smile just look handsome as anything and happy and carefree, you know, and I can't do that. I wish I could do it. I can't do it. And I just tell them, because jazz is hard.
It is hard.
If you come see me do, you know, an R&B gig and we're playing Motown tunes that I've known since I'm born, I can sit there and smile all night, you know, because I don't have to think that much.
No.
You know?
And that's a really good point.
It's still good music.
Jazz is a lot about thinking.
Jazz is a rather complex music.
Yeah, that's right.
There are, and it isn't good or bad. Yeah. And, you know, music that's simple isn't bad because it's simple and it just is what it is. It more resembles classical than any other kind of music.
Yeah.
In fact, Max Roach, the great drummer, calls jazz American classical music.
Nice.
Which it kind of is.
Yeah,
It's homegrown right here.
Yes.
We invented it.
All right, so you come out of high school, essentially, with almost everything you need, right?
I had already been doing gigs for 2 years.
Yes.
By the time I got out of high school.
Yeah, yeah. What kind?
Some very good gigs, in fact. Mostly jazz gigs. Mm-hmm. And some R&B.
Mm-hmm. Because you can play anything, because all music is matter.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It took me a while to learn to be good in R&B bands because jazz was my main thing coming up.
Yeah.
And you have to simplify quite a lot to make it good R&B. In R&B, if you play too many 13ths and 9ths, you know, if you make it too complex, it doesn't work.
No.
It's kind of like hot pepper used in cooking. A little bit of it makes some spice, but too much ruins it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So I could add a little here and there, but mostly keep it simple.
Simple. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the rhythm was no problem. Rhythm I understood since birth. You know.
Okay, so the New England Conservatory, you go through it, you come out of it with whatever they had to offer you, and then what?
Well, then I built this recording studio in Boston,
right.
And I was a staff composer for 5 years. I wrote thousands of pieces of music, mostly forgotten, mostly like little pieces for corporate events and jingles and low-budget AM radio things. But I learned how to score music. That is scoring in terms of film, which basically means you get a list of cues. Cues are pieces, and it's the exact length and the mood that needs to be set by those cues.
Right.
For example, you know, 5 seconds mysterious sound. Then you have a cue for 13 seconds, which is expecting something is about to happen. And then, you know what I mean, a romantic theme, 1 minute, 12 seconds. And you have to write all these pieces of music.
Right.
So probably over 5 years' time, I wrote at least 1,000 pieces of music. Many of them were a minute or so. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As well as writing songs, too.
Mm-hmm.
I have three, for example, on my album, Hot Sauce, I have 3 original songs. The rest are standard jazz tunes.
Okay, so here you are in Boston, working your ass off, right? I mean, and I'm assuming you're playing some gigs as well? No?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I had times where I did not leave the loft. It was a loft building. We had two floors, 14-foot ceilings, enormous, like a whole factory building kind of lofts. They were cheap in those days. Mm-hmm. And we had a soundstage downstairs, and we built like little living areas, like small rooms over in the corner, a large soundstage for recording. And then upstairs we had the recording studio. It was all wired. And there were times where I did not leave that building for weeks at a time.
Oh my goodness.
When we had that much work.
Right.
I hooked up with a good outfit called Envision, and they really gave me my start. They were a video production company, and they were one of the biggest in Boston at that time. I don't know if they're still there. I imagine they are. And I got started. Fidelity Mutual Bank, I believe they're no longer in business. And yeah, I believe that was my first job, doing a scoring piece, which is like doing a movie.
Yeah.
You get a certain number of cues and whatever else. Yeah, you want to hear a funny story?
Of course.
This is a very humbling experience. I had no idea what I was doing. There was
you mean when you started?
Your first job. No one knows what they're doing the first job.
Right.
This is my first day on the job, basically. I was a great musician already. I was talented, but I didn't know about writing music for banks, corporate America. I didn't know what it was. So I had this job with 13 pieces of music, various different lengths, a minute to 4 minutes, whatever. So I wrote 13 pieces of music. I put on a cassette, and I had a meeting with the lady who was in charge of this job. So I went to the Envision headquarters. I walked. Everything was in it. It was all done. Boston's a small town. So I walk over. I'm shaking in my boots. I'm a little nervous. I'm 18. Maybe I was 19 already. I don't know. And pop in the cassette. We listened, and she listened with furrowed brow. She stopped about halfway through, and she said, "Do you know what this job is for?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, it's Fidelity Mutual." She says, "What do they do?" And I said, it's a bank." She said, "Yeah, bank, right? Bank, yeah?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "This music sounds like it's for children with leukemia."
Oh, my God.
Those were her exact words.
Oh, my God.
It was sad and brooding, and she said, "For a bank, you want music that's strong. It sounds powerful. We're going to protect your money. Your investment is safe with us." And she's making it, and I'm thinking, I'm a hair's breadth away from losing this job. She said, "I'll give you 2 days, 48 hours. You come back with something that sells, or you're off the job."
Wow.
Well, that's life in the real world.
Yeah, no kidding. So,
you know. Yeah, and so so all 3 inches of me crawled out of the studio and crawled back to my loft, and I got to work. And then I played her the 13 examples 2 days later, and she smiled, and she said, "Okay, kid, you got the job."
Oh, it's great.
And you had to make changes.
Right, you know, right.
This needs to be, start this off slower, whatever.
Right,
you know,
right.
But yeah, that was my first job, and then I hit the ground running. I didn't have any training at all in composition, or in movie scoring, and working for film and television, video. I knew a lot about music.
Okay, so you did that for 5 years, is that what you said?
About 5 years, yeah. And then after that, I went to Los Angeles for about a year, and then went to New York. I stayed in New York for quite a while.
And what were you doing?
Well, now, in New York, I had this peculiar job that was, it was an Italian wedding band. It was one of these offices that gets tons of work, and they have several different bands that they farm the work out to.
Ah, yeah.
And,
like an agency.
Yeah, it was an agency. It was an Italian wedding band agency. And I went from Guido Outpost to Guido Outpost, from Brooklyn to the Bronx to Long Island, you know. And it was a very, very interesting experience. I've always known a lot of Italian people and had, but you know, Jews and Italians, we have a lot in common. And it's funny, most everybody who worked for that outfit who wasn't Italian was Jewish. But I was very, very fortunate. We did these high-paying weddings between Friday and Sunday. And I hardly ever worked Monday to Friday.
Oh, God.
So I had all that time to do whatever I wanted.
Right.
So I was making good money just on the weekend. And during the week, then I had all this time, and I got pretty heavily into composing.
Uh-huh.
And I started writing a lot of songs. I ended up selling 2 songs to the Rascals.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were putting out an album of new music with a new singer. and they had lost their singer, Eddie Bergatti, and their keyboard player, organist, Felix Cavalier. Everybody knows him from their big hits, Good Lovin', Groovin' on a Sunday Afternoon and all that. And yeah, I had the honor of writing a few songs for them. I actually wrote three. They took two, and they recorded them. They were never released.
Oh.
They had legal, all kinds of legal problems, but it was a great experience. I learned a lot. I worked with some of the best recording studios. And then I had my biggest success at that time writing music. I wrote a theme song for what is now the Discovery Network.
Oh.
It was originally aired on ABC. It was called Zoo Life Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It's still on in Europe, actually.
So you're getting residuals?
No. I sold it.
Oh, no.
No, I know not to do that now,
no,
but what
know,
did I know?
Right,
I was a kid.
Right.
You know, most people do this the first time out.
Yeah, that's
very
right.
Very
that's right. That's right. No, no, that's very right.
But, no, if I had it over, if I had it to do over again, I probably would do the same because they weren't offering that. They were offering a one-time thing.
Right, right, right.
And
right.
In those days,
yeah,
I had a small studio in my apartment in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
13th Avenue. Prospect Heights, Park
mm-hmm.
Slope area, which now is chic. You can't even get in there. You know, I mean, that apartment is like $500 a month. It's probably $10,000 a month now. But I had a small studio, and in my studio, me and one other guy made $10,000 in one night's work. So,
well, yeah, right.
I mean, that was 1990,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, right, right.
Anyway, so to be able to make that $5,000 in one night, I didn't mind giving it away.
No.
And then I wrote another version for it, a vocal version with lyrics. And then we recorded that in Boston. I happened to be in Boston at the time. Went to my old recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys gave me the time for free. I didn't have to pay anything.
Right.
I had paid the singer. So I made another, I don't even remember what I made off that. But so it was very good money. I got my name around. I still have my name in the credits.
Okay, so you're in New York. You're gigging and you're writing and it sounds good, right? You're here now.
Yeah, well, I came down to visit my parents occasionally in
Did
Florida.
Did they live here?
Yes, my parents were retired and living in Lido Beach. And at the time, I was paying, I think it was $800 for a three-story walk-up in a neighborhood where you would get accosted by about 20 crackheads on the way out of the car into the apartment. You know, I started wondering, why am I banging my head against the wall? I came down here in Florida, I just fell in love with it, especially Sarasota. Really, I mean, there are a lot of beautiful places in Florida, but to me, Sarasota's the finest of all. And I just remember, you know, there was this moment in my life where I just was a little confounded with New York. I had stopped the wedding thing, and I was kind of at odds, and I was down here walking along the beach with my mother, and she said something I'll never forget. She said, you know, I often wonder, why didn't I come down here when I was young and I could enjoy it? Well, I could go boating, and I could go running and bicycling. I could swim every day. You know, I go for a walk, I swim a little, I splash around in the water, and I was thinking, you know, I'm young, I can enjoy this. And then the other thing that clicked in was, my father had this apartment right on the beach that was cheaper than my apartment, on the ninth floor, huge three-room, two-bedroom apartment, views of downtown on one side, views of the beach on the other side, the sunrise, the sunset, I mean, and I'm thinking, you know, I could have this cheaper than what I have. And the only thing that stood in my way is I thought, you know, there's probably no music around here.
So
laugh. I know you're going to laugh. You know, I mean, when you come from New York, you know, people in New York, they think there's no culture
there's nothing outside of New York, right?
You know, my father knew some musicians. So he said, well, you know, let me take you around. Maybe, you know, maybe you'll meet some guys. I came down here for 1 week and I met probably 20 or 30 musicians.
Wow.
And some really, really good ones. And it occurred to me, it was like an epiphany. It doesn't matter that there are millions of musicians in New York. You don't work with millions of musicians. You work with 20 or 30 musicians. You have two or three good bands, a couple good jazz bands, a couple good R&B bands. It's 10, 20 guys, 30 maximum that you work with. And I know that there are 30 or more really good musicians right here. I can live cheaper, have a better life. It's much safer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got robbed, burglarized. I stepped over dead bodies in the street. I'm not making that up. Yeah, I was held up at gunpoint. There was crack, heroin, everything, needles on the street, you know. And I just, you know, enough. That's enough. And I came down here. I haven't regretted it. I just love this area. I lived in Paris for 5 years. During the Sarasota time, I met a very nice girl and got married. Well, I went to France with her. She was from the south of France, and we lived in Paris together for 5 years. Ended up divorcing her, and I wanted to come back to Sarasota. And, I mean, I could have stayed in... I tell people, this is how much I love Sarasota. I had a nice life in Paris. I owned my own apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working quite a lot. I wasn't at first, but mind you, it took some time. I had to learn to speak French well and everything. But I could have stayed in Paris and have a pretty nice life. I could have gone back to Michigan. I could have gone back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I could have gone to Brooklyn or Los Angeles. I had connections out there. Or Sarasota. And I prefer Sarasota over all those places.
Wow.
I haven't regretted it for a moment.
So when did you come back?
In 01, shortly after the terrorist attacks. Something about that also made me want to be back with my people and my culture.
Yeah.
It's, you know, these things affect us, you know.
Yes, they do.
Well, also, I was getting more religious, and I wanted to marry a Jewish girl.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know, I had a feeling I was going to meet her in Florida. And my wife now mm-hmm. was at that time leaving South America to come to Miami, capital of South America, to, you know, to try to find a Jewish husband. She came from an area with very few Jews.
Wow.
So her father gave her some money and sent her here and said, just find a good guy. I don't care if he makes a lot of money. I don't care if he's dirt poor. Find a good man. Somebody's going to care about you. Take good care of you. And that's rare in America.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so she came to Miami, and I met her through a mutual friend who was traveling back and forth between Miami and Sarasota a lot. And I always invited him over. You know, I said, look, there's not much kosher stuff around here. Let me fix you lunch. Mm-hmm. Let me get, well, I'm busy. Don't worry about it. Let me get you a sandwich, you know. And he was kind of touched. He's a much older man. We became very good friends. He's a lovely man. And he ended up introducing me to Camila, my wife.
So let me see if I got this right. She's coming from South America looking for a Jewish husband. You're coming from Paris looking for a Jewish wife.
And we meet.
And you meet in Florida.
In Florida.
Oh, man.
Over the phone first. He gave me her phone number, and I called her, and we talked. And she said, oh, I can email. I said, I don't have a computer. Said, wow, you are old-fashioned. She said, look, I can send you a photograph. I said, no. Let's get to know each other on the phone.
Yeah.
Because I care more about your soul than your face right now. At that point, I already was not a kid. I'm already like 40 at that point.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So it's like, I knew what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't care that I wanted to get straight to the meat of the issue. And so I said, look, you know, if things work out on the phone, I'll drive over and I'll see you in Miami, which I did a few weeks later.
Wow.
And the rest is history.
So how long have you been married?
11 years.
Wow. And how old is your son?
My son's 7.
Well, mazel tov.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, all right. So now we have you here, right? And I know you work. I know you work because I've seen you been work. And that's,
yes.
That's how I met you, is I saw you working.
That's how I eat.
Yes, right.
I work.
Right, exactly. Now, you mentioned early on something about having discovered a way to teach.
Yes, this has been something that's really been great in the last 10, 15 years or so. I've been teaching a lot more.
Teaching what?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. You know what?
No.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have taught a lot of things over the years. I've taught languages as well as music, but mostly I teach music.
Mm-hmm. As in piano?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's the thing. When I started out teaching many years ago, it was only to supplement income, and I would have a student or two, and it was just teaching piano. But I learned something from my experiences studying music theory, and I've come up with a simple system where I can teach anyone at any level on any instrument, even if it's an instrument I don't play at all.
Really?
So I have a course of music theory, and basically I call it the building blocks of music theory. I don't have exactly a name for it yet. I can call it the Rose System. And a lot of people told me, you know, you should put a book out of this.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I might just do that. There are a lot of books on music. Most of them are terrible.
Yes.
Most of them are by great musicians and great teachers, but they're too complicated. They don't give you the basic building blocks first. All music is composed of the same building blocks, no matter what instrument you play. That is to say, the fundamentals of harmony, music theory, fundamentals of melody, and in lyrical music, the fundamentals of poetry are the same to all instruments. So I have a course of music theory for all instruments, all levels. I'll tell you the truth, it really solidified in Paris. In my first year in Paris, I have some gift with languages, and I never had any lessons, but I speak French quite fluently.
Mm-hmm.
But it took about a year. So in the first year, I wasn't working that much. Frankly, my wife was supporting me, my ex,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that's not a good situation. So I started teaching, I found that in America, just like in France, excuse me, just like in America when you say, oh, this is a French product, it sounds chic.
Yes, right.
Something sexy about it, right?
Right.
So in France, you advertise yourself as American. It's American. Ooh,
yes, yes.
I was imported.
Yes.
All of a sudden, I was an imported product.
Right.
So I took an ad out in a local musical paper. I said, course of music theory for all instruments, all levels, taught by acclaimed American jazz pianist.
Perfect.
Yeah, and I got a lot of calls. I taught musicians on many instruments, a couple of which I don't play at all. Now, I do play a lot of instruments. Mm-hmm. I play piano and keyboards, Hammond organ. I also play guitar and bass.
Right.
And I had some lessons on trumpet and saxophone and clarinet as well. So all of those instruments I know pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had, like, I had a couple of vocalists, one classical vocalist.
So what did you teach that person?
Music theory. And I can teach it on the piano or on the guitar or other instruments. The best is on the piano because it's very visual and totally linear. It all goes from low to high. You can see where everything's at.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a very, very simple example. All chords are created by thirds.
Right.
What is a third? Simple way to put it, play a note, skip the next note, then play the following note. Skip the next note, play the following note.
Right.
Those are thirds.
Right.
That's a simple way to create a chord. Play a note, skip a note, play the next note, skip a note, play the next note. After one lesson, you can already play a few songs. Really? Even if you don't know where middle C is. Because I teach you from a very, very basic thing, right? Then once you start to get to understand that, I take a C major scale, all white notes, and then I make a chord out of each note, each scale degree. Those are called diatonic triads.
Right.
This is the fundamentals of all Western music. Because you see, that's a one chord, then a two chord, then a three chord, then a four chord. Then most music, most pop songs is 1-4-5. That's it. It's still, there's clever ways to do it. You could go 1-4, 1-4-5, 1-5.
Right.
It's how long you stay in each chord.
Okay,
the fundamentals are actually quite simple.
Okay, but so what you're saying is that if the song was in C, it would be 1-4-5, you would have that. But then if the song's in B flat, you have to learn the...
They're different notes, but the relationships are exactly the same. That's why I call this the number system.
Right.
Because once you learn it, everything's the same in every key. You have to know your scales. If you know your A-flat scale as well as you know your C scale, anything you play in C, you can play in A-flat, because the relationships are the same.
Oh,
1-4-5 is still the same. It's just A-flat, D-flat, E-flat, instead of C-F-G. It's not as complicated as it sounds, I assure you.
I believe you. All right. So now you're still teaching.
I do teach.
You're writing.
Yes, I'm writing. Did I mention I have a CD out?
Yeah.
Only about 16 times. Shameless self-promotion.
So when did you do this?
So this record, Hot Sauce, by one of my bands, the Organic Trio, called mm-hmm. So Organic because it features a Hammond organ. Or shall I say me, Robbie Rose, on the Hammond organ. And I have a few original songs there. The title cut is one of the strongest songs on there. That's an original song. And yeah, I'm writing a lot. This was recorded 6 years ago now.
Didn't you say you had a website?
Mm-hmm.
And what is it?
Robbie Rose Music. That's on YouTube. And my Facebook is Robbie Rose Entertainer.
Aha. Okay, but you don't have a website then, because that would be something.com.
Oh, I don't have a .com, no.
Yes,
no.
Right.
Not
that
yet.
Would be, right, okay.
Not yet.
So you could be found on YouTube.
Yes, in fact, you can just Google Robbie Rose.
And you can find all that.
It's a common name, so there are a few, but I'm one of the first. If you Google me within Sarasota, I'm one of the first.
Right.
Or you can just go Facebook, Robbie Rose Entertainer, and you see all my gigs and stuff, and that can take you also to my YouTube site, and you can hear some of my music. And also, my CD is normally $10, but I'm offering, if anybody goes on my Facebook, give me a like on the Facebook, and I'll give you a CD, $5.
Oh, lovely. All right. Now, are you playing someplace regularly?
The only thing that I have regularly right now, and you never know how long last,
I'm not sure, but
at the moment, at Casariano's on Venice Ave in Venice, every Wednesday night.
If you hurry down, because we all know that it's musical chairs with the musicians and who's playing where in Sarasota.
Yeah.
But for a moment, anyway, you could get Robbie live at
Casariano's Wednesday nights.
In the Italian restaurant?
Italian restaurant. I hear it's very good. I haven't eaten the food. But the best is to check on my Facebook.
On your Facebook.
Just go Facebook.
Right.
And you don't have to be on Facebook. Anybody can look at it. It's,
right.
It's set up so anyone, public, can see everything's on there. Just Facebook, and then search Robbie Rose Entertainer, and you have all the information. I hate to send people down to a gig, and I don't know, maybe by the time they hear this...
That's right. You just remember call them.
And yeah, check. Or call Castellanos and Jay. You remember the old New Yorker magazine?
Yes,
it's
right.
Still printed,
right,
I guess.
Right.
I don't know if it's as viable as it used to be, but it used to be the place in New York to check music.
Yeah.
And my father used to always use this as an example of how, what a crazy business it is, because at the beginning of the music section, it has a disclaimer. I don't know if you ever,
no,
you ever noticed this?
Know.
Yeah, I haven't seen it recently. I don't know if they still do, but they always did years ago when I was growing up. And my father would make me read it and point it out to me,
right,
as an example of how crazy the music
right.
business is. The disclaimer read, and I paraphrase, something to the effect of, musicians live crazy lives. We never know for sure if these listings will be the same by the time you're reading them as at the time that we printed them. So it's always a good idea to call ahead and make sure the musician's there, or if there's some sidemen you want to see, check who's in the band, because it might be the same musician but a different band, and there might be somebody, and he got a tour in Europe, and he's got him, and it was like a whole paragraph disclaimer of, like, you know, anything goes in this business, you never know, right?
That's hilarious.
Yeah, that was always, every week it was in the New Yorker magazine. And, you know, my father used to use that as an
that
example.
Lovely.
It's a tough business, and, you know, it's true.
Okay, so I have one other question.
Yes, ma'am.
And that is, having given a life, and you have given a life to music, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
I'll tell you a brief story, which will illustrate. I worked on cruise ships for many years. Yeah, I wouldn't want to do it now, but it was very good when I was younger. And, you know, you're out at sea, it can get boring at times, and you finish a job, you know, most guys go down to the crew recreation area, shoot pool, play cards, have a drink, and chat. One time I was sitting around with a bunch of people from all different countries, a couple South Americans, a few English guys, there was a great singer from Ontario, Canada, and myself, and somebody said a challenge, let's go around the circle, and everybody say what's the best thing you've done in your life, and what's the worst thing you've done in your life. And one lady said, oh, the best thing I've done in my life was to spend a few months with my mother when she was dying. The worst thing I ever did in my life was to try drugs. And then another guy says, oh, I regret this, and I didn't. Right, it comes to me, and I said, very simple, I said, the best thing I ever did in my life was to become a musician, and the worst thing I ever did in my life was to become a musician.
Yeah, right.
It illustrates.
It definitely does.
Yeah, I wish to say, to give equal weight, I have no regrets and I love my life. The good Lord blesses me all the time. I'm very, very fortunate, and I love doing music and I love being in music, and I'm very proud that I'm able to survive in music. But then at the same time, I gotta tell you, it's an extremely hard life. There's a lot of things that people tell you about, like, you know, it's difficult to make enough money. But a lot of things people don't tell you about. A lot of things that people don't realize. Music is very, very hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We keep strange hours. Mm-hmm. We carry a lot of heavy equipment around. We're sometimes treated great. We're sometimes treated like garbage.
Mm-hmm.
There are some times where there are plenty of... even to this day, I'm in my 50s. I've been doing it for a long time. I'm one of the better guys around.
Yeah.
There are sometimes when I'm respected very, very highly. Sometimes where an illegal alien dishwasher is treated with more respect,
yes,
than I am. Like a guy who got here last week, doesn't speak or read or write, even in his native language,
yeah,
far less our language, you know, and he gets better treatment and makes more money.
Yeah.
You know, than I do. And so, you know, that's... people will tip a 20-year-old kid who valet parks their car 10 yards away.
Right.
They'll give him $5. But a brilliant, gifted musician who sends a shiver up their spine and makes them cry happy tears and sing and dance and rejoice and appreciate life more, we get nothing.
That's right.
Nothing.
I know. So that's part of the challenge of being a musician, for sure.
What I said previously, you know, goes there. Are, sometimes I get great respect.
Yeah.
And sometimes I get nothing.
Well, I want to say that I respect you terrifically. I have seen you play any number of times, and I know how good you are.
Oh, thank you, sweetie.
Well, you're very welcome. I think this is a good place to stop. Thank you so much, Robbie Rose.
Thank you for having me, Lynn. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be your real, whole, entire, true self. Because at least in the area of their work, people who have chosen to make a life and try to make a living within art in this culture are people who are doing what it is right for them to do, what their self tells them they are. And Robbie Rose, of course, makes this point in Neon. He always knew he was a musician. He says at the beginning of the interview, it never occurred to me to do anything else. Actually, he says, why would anyone do anything other than music? This is coming from his essential self. The psychological term for this is congruence. You know, the colloquial term is, you know, what you see is what you got, what there is. And so when you listen to Robbie, you hear it. And it is my hope that when you listen to Robbie and people like him, all the people that I interview really, you ask yourself, is this true for me? Am I so in love with how I am living my life that even though there are serious downsides to it, I wouldn't trade? I wouldn't give up being myself, even though being myself comes with a price? Well, if you can say that, hooray for you and call me because I'd like to interview you for the show. But if you can't say that, then I want to tell you that it's not too late. I want to tell you that the possibility of recapturing whatever it is you may have to have denied or sacrificed or abandoned in your childhood, it's still there. And again, it is my hope that listening to people like Robbie inspires you to attempt to recover yourself, live the life you were really meant to live. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. As I said, something that inspires you to ask yourself, to pursue yourself if you haven't got all of yourself. But maybe it's just listening to the amusing and charming Robbie Rose, or listening to his original composition called Hot Sauce, which we are going to go out on. So, again, as always, I hope you got something from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too. We'll be right back.
Sister Phoenix, we won't give up.
started singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten